That was left unattended last week was why the significance of the third in those beginning calamities. Why a third of the fish in the sea and a third of the ships in the sea and a third of the crops, and what's the significance of the third? This has nothing to do with the Trinity. I know that's often like the go-to bit, because whenever there's a three, it's not about that. So there are two kind of dominant schools of thought over this. Certainly what happens practically is as the calamities unfold, it starts with a quarter. So if you recall with the four horsemen, they were each given charge over a quarter, and then it was a quarter of the population, a quarter of the population, a quarter of the population. Then as we move into the situation with the trumpets, now we have a third of this, a third of that, a third of that. So on a basic narrative level, it's simply progressively bigger. This is becoming a bigger deal or a bigger problem. More and more people are involved. There's also, at least this is what's proposed, a kind of a cultural dynamic. So Jews would use, I'm somewhat anachronizing here, but I'm trying to communicate the idea. In the same way, we might say sort of about a dozen to indicate a significant amount of something, they would use a third to indicate less than half, and so not a whole thing. And so the idea is that it's playing off of the progressive piece, but right, what you're going to see here is first is a quarter of people that wind up affected by these things, and then it's a third, and then it's more than half, which is why the third would be significant. Then it's more than half, and then eventually it's everybody who's left, right? So that the situation is just getting progressively and progressively bad. There are other explanations for the thirds, but they all seem so exotic that it didn't seem worth trying to pursue. The question of who belongs to which gang of multitudes, which was the other question, is important, but I think we're going to see the various groups of multitudes that show up sort of converge. And so who they are earlier on may get muted as the story progresses. Okay? Anything else before I kind of just launch in? All right. So we ended last week with the seventh trumpet. The angel blows the trumpet. There's a voice in heaven. The 24 elders fall on their faces and begin to worship God, and they sing another hymn. And then, this is the part, the end bit is what's important. And then God's temple was opened, the temple in heaven. So this is not the temple that John was sent to measure with the stick. This is the temple in heaven. Then God's temple in heaven was opened. The Ark of the Covenant was seen within his temple. Significant, right? Because we talked about last week. Where's the Ark? Unclear. A lot of claimants. But the in the vision of the book of Revelation, at least at this stage, the Ark isn't even on earth anymore. The Ark is in heaven. Now, whether that's literal or figurative may not matter deeply, but in the imagination of the person writing this, they want you to see the Ark, the one that was on earth, now in heaven. And there were flashes of lightning and rumbling and peals of thunder and an earthquake and heavy hail. So all of this other stuff, like all of these signs, positive or negative?
Negative.
Yeah, right. These are not things like we don't like them now, and people with like less good construction like them less. It's like hail might get us an insurance claim, got you just like no roof, right? So this is an indication that God's temple is opened. We see something marvelous, and then more bad stuff. Okay, so we jump right from there into chapter 12 and the woman and the dragon. So, and then this is familiar to us, but I deliberately picked an image that wasn't Our Lady of Guadalupe because we so quickly associate there. I think it's important to hear it and see it in a kind of more neutral context. Basically, what we're hitting today are most of the biggest symbols or metaphors, allegories that exist in the book. And I'm not going to be able to name all of them, but I wanted to just see what the symbol is. So today we're looking at the red octagon with the letters on it. Next week we may be talking about where stop signs come from. That's the idea. Okay. So a great portent appeared in the heavens, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant and was crying out in birth pangs in the agony of giving birth. Then another portent appeared in heaven, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and 7 diadems on his heads. His tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And then the dragon stood before the woman who was about to bear a child, so that he might devour her child as soon as it was born. And she gave birth to a son, a male child, who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. But her child was snatched away and taken to God and to his throne. And the woman fled to the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, so that she can be nourished for 1,260 days. All right. Initial thoughts. What's that?
All the specific number of days.
Yeah. So the numbering bit is important, and that is, all number questions are tabled the next week because I have an actual table. But it'll be easier when we can see them all up together than to try and hit each one individually. That's a good point. Number of days. Also, number of appendages and stuff. Isn't this weird? So it's a dragon. We've got an idea what that looks like, but it's got 7 heads. Oh, this now, there's a lot going on there. And 10 horns. So each head has a horn, and then some have 2. And then diadems on top of the heads with the horns, next to the horn or on the... Okay, so, right, the numbers are going to be what's significant here, not the image, as it were. The image, though, is significant, and it's the reason that Revelation has been... One of the reasons Revelation has been so difficult to depict, right? Do most creatures have multiple heads?
No.
Most of the time, for most creatures, like us and most of the animals we would have anything to do with, if a creature has more than one head, is it good for the creature generally or bad for the creature?
Bad
for the creature, right? So very occasionally, right, you'll see a hog or a calf born with 2 heads. This never works out well, right? They almost always die. Or if they live, it's real hard to run them because you're not supposed to be built that way, right? It's very, very important to understand here that the word that comes into English from the Old Testament as impure or unclean is not a hygiene word. It's not in origin about dirt, and cleanliness isn't like what we do in the bathroom precisely. It's about place. So the reason that you don't boil a calf in its mother's milk, so the reason you can't have a cheeseburger, is because it seems unfitting for the child to be cooked in the liquid that was meant to feed it. It's out of place. That isn't where baby cows belong, in their milk. The milk belongs inside them, right? The reason shellfish are considered unclean isn't because they didn't know how to cook them. Everybody around them knew how to cook shellfish. They also knew how sick you could get if you didn't cook the shellfish, but the problem wasn't the shellfish, and it wasn't because crabs are especially poopy or something. But it's because shellfish are basically water bugs. They're more complex, but for a person without Linnaeus's taxonomy, you're going to look at that and you're going to go, that is a roach in the water. I shouldn't eat that. In a kind of flat-footed way. The reason cemeteries make you unclean or handling dead bodies isn't because they're afraid of contagion from the body. That's a new idea. It's that cemeteries are literally the cities of the dead. Dead people belong in cemeteries. Living people do not belong in cemeteries. And so which is the reason you can become unclean. This is the reason this is important. You can become unclean actually by proximity to the holy. So there are times that the priests are rendered unclean by their service, so they have to go do a thing and then take a time out from the temple until they get clean again and then come back in, because stuff winds up out of order, out of proportion, not sort of visually the way that we'd recognize. Disproportionate or out of order. Well, any animal with a whole bunch of heads or a whole bunch of extra limbs that they're not supposed to have. A dog is not supposed to have 6 legs, right? And lizards, at least in general, are not supposed to have multiple heads. the dragon comes up again and again, so we can do more with him later. But that's basically going on there. What about the woman? What do we think about her?
I can't. I'm whenever I read that, I'm thinking, well, the child went to heaven mm-hmm. with God, and why was the woman, the mother of the baby, taken to a desert, even though it was prepared by God?
It's a great question.
Is the woman representing Mary, or is she representing Israel, or is she representing the church?
Yes. I mean, and this is part of the problem. So we have a tendency, for all kinds of reasons, historically, to assume that most symbols are unitary. So that you have a symbol, and that symbol stands for a singular other thing. When in fact, in history, most symbols have a lot of meaning attached to them, more than one meaning attached to them, and that meaning may be inherent in the symbol itself, or it may be derived from context. And so so if you look at the flag, it's our great national symbol. I know I've stumbled in trying to talk about national symbols before, but this one I think I can get. So if you look at the flag, right, we've got what colors?
Red, white, blue.
Okay, so what are those symbolized? Those of you that served and know more than me know better. Why these particular colors? What's the red?
Blood.
The blood of the martyrs of the nation. Those first soldiers especially, and then ultimately anyone who served. White.
Honor,
virtue, purity. But it plays off of the same cultural norms, right? The people that made this came from this same tradition. So they're trucking in the same imagery, right? And then the blue. So there's certainly, like, the stars are in the sky, right? So the field of stars is on the field of blue. Yeah. You don't have blue stripes, right? That's true. And then the blue is typically associated more with honor, loyalty, fidelity, something like that. But the point is that the flag itself, and then, of course, you've got the stars. How many stars?
50.
How many states?
50.
Okay, so does the flag stand for each state? Or you see what's happening? It's a multiple symbol. It stands for more than one thing. Now, the things that it's going to stand for are often being in contradiction to each other, or it's going to be kind of a bad symbol. You're not going to be able to tell what it's trying to communicate. But you can have complementary meanings so that a symbol can stand for all kinds of different things. Right? So who is the woman of Revelation? The answer is complex because the portent appears to tell us different things, right? So you have this woman who's dressed in this particular way, who's pregnant and is in the middle of the birth pangs, right? And this is a weird image. I shouldn't say that. It is hard to find, and I never did, but I'm not going to say that means it doesn't exist, to find the image as it's actually sort of being presented. I mean, the text seemed to suggest that, like, we're in those opening moments of the TV episode, and she's on the gurney like this, and the dragon's at the foot of the bed, yeah. Right? And so now obviously nobody wants to depict this woman that way, especially if she is who she might be. So that isn't what we've got. But what's strange about this is, okay, so on the one hand, somebody make an argument for Mary. What are the things about this that suggest Mary?
The birth of the male child.
Where does the male child go?
To heaven.
And to God and his?
His throne.
Throne. Who's sitting on the throne? The Lamb. The Lamb's been sitting on the throne the whole time, right? So clearly we're supposed to be associated. And what is this kid going to do? The male child who is to rule all the nations. Okay, so and who's the ruler of the nations? Jesus, we already established that. That was like chapter one, right? So on the one hand, we're clearly supposed to be identifying this baby with Jesus, which would seem to indicate Mary as the woman. What makes it sound like not like that?
Pains.
So Mary's childbirth is painless. Good. What else?
Is that actually like a doctor?
Yeah, it is. We can come back to that if you don't like it, but the answer is yes. Deal with it. Now what that means is complex, but for the purposes of focusing on the symbol. So what else? What else would seem to speak against it?
That she's gone into the wilderness.
Yeah, she disappears, right? And we don't have, there's no other story that we got of Mary running off to the desert. Like nobody, that's not a thing that we know of in the bit, right? Again, putting herself in the minds of the initial hearers. Anything else that would make it?
Father, what's the dark thing in the middle? I can't really see it. It looks like a hand, maybe.
This here, you mean? That's just the bow holding her stuff together. So what they're trying to do, it's a little hard to see with the light, but what you've got, they're trying to make clear that she's pregnant, right? So she's got a big belly. Mm-hmm. And if you look as you leave, with the images of Guadalupe, this is typically the way, this is the way ancient Jewish women indicated pregnancy. So you would move your belt sort of from your waist up sort of under your boobs and over the bump, right? Like that, this was the indicator. But this was a really important social signal. Most ancient cultures had some way, by a form of dress, to show people you were pregnant, so that people knew you were pregnant and didn't do things to you that could cause harm to you or the baby. But most, I don't want to say this right, the images of Mary that are meant to show her as pregnant almost always have something up here that's trunk, and that's what it's trying to show you. But it is just kind of oddly, I get that it looks funny up there. Okay, so that's the argument for Mary. What's the argument for, what was your other?
Israel.
What's the argument for Israel?
The 12 stars.
12 stars.
12 tribes.
Mm-hmm. Good, excellent. Israel, of course, faces off against nations that identify themselves with dragons, right? So this is a real thing. So you've got some of the imagery is the symbol itself. Some of it's contrasted, and we're going to see a bunch of contrasting symbols, right? We have the woman giving birth here. Now we're going to see a whore at the end, right? Well, that's deliberate. These two women are meant to be sort of compared and contrasted with each other. Okay, so here you have the woman and the dragon. So there's an argument for Israel, and then the other version, right, is the church. The three dominant interpretations, right, are Mary, Israel, and the church. And there is no unity. There's no official teaching on this, and there kind of couldn't be because it's designed to be a multivalent symbol. It's designed to mean more than one thing at the same time. And so the argument here on the church, right, is that the church doesn't birth Christ, but it births Christians, and so that it's sort of its birth in this child that's carried away is all of Christendom. Everybody who's ever going to come out of the church. We don't use the language of church's mother as much now as we did in most of history. It became very unfashionable in the 60s, and then people just kind of stopped it. Ancient churches, and especially ancient baptistries, are redolent with maternal imagery because the primary symbolic dynamism intended was rebirth, to be reborn of water and the Spirit. One cannot re-enter his mother's womb and be born again, can he? By water and the Spirit. And so ancient baptismal fonts typically take on one of two architectural motifs. The most common is that of a tomb. So ancient, I mean by this like before 5th century fonts, are often the sort of, we think of them as like jacuzzi or hot tub style. It's not quite like our cattle trough that we pull out in a couple weeks, but it's they're typically, they look like a big jacuzzi, built into the floor, three steps down, and then three steps back up. And the outer rim of the pool is made to look like a tomb, a stone tomb, carstone tomb. The Leaning Tower of Pisa was originally designed in this way. Probably the best example of this kind of architecture comes from Dura Europa's in North Africa, which is the oldest sort of complete Christian church with all the bits that we've got, right? It's to the end of the second century. It's built like this. But the maternal imagery would be like the second most common sort of piece. And here, please just hear this. This is just Father being descriptive. It's not trying to be weird or creepy or nothing. The imagery is labial, right? So it's made to look like a womb. This isn't Dan Brown. That's not being creepy like that. But the idea is that the church is birthing you. And so that we are rightly, like in a strong way, not just in a vague symbolic way, but in a strong and meaningful way, sons and daughters of the church. And so the church then becomes mother. St. John the 23rd, right? Always referred to the church as mother and mistress or mother and teacher, right? And so the woman of Revelation appears to be more than one thing. And it's important that she appears to be more than one thing because pretty much everything else we're about to see is going to be more than one thing. I was trying to come up with a good parallel last night. So Tolkien and Lewis famously fought about this stuff all the time because Lewis wanted there to be clear parallels between the characters in his books with this kind of stuff, right? So Aslan the lion just really is Jesus. Like, there's not a serious question about who this character is. He puts Jesus' words in the lion's mouth. He has the lion, like, tied down and murdered so that he's sacrificed for other people. Like, there's clearly a one-to-one kind of parallel there. Tolkien deliberately doesn't do that. He creates characters that are like this thing, but not like it in that way. Right, so that the symbols are at least potentially more potent, that they can mean more than one thing, like the flag bit. Well, perhaps a slightly more accessible version here for us, because I realize not all of you read those books, would be something as simple as Superman. Okay, is Superman a Christ figure? Well, his daddy's name is El. He's comes from another place and is sent by his father. He winds up, in some way or other, saving the world. And in the version with the kid from Iowa, he literally dies like this. Okay? So, now, does that mean Superman is Jesus? No. He's Superman. And Clark Kent, I suppose. But, right, Superman. He's another character. But that character, like, for us to even understand what's going on with him, we have to have some vague sense of who Jesus is. Otherwise, these symbols that the person attaches to him won't make sense. The trouble with us in Revelation is what we're trying to do is that kind of work, but with a cultural framework that probably nobody actually has, at least in its entirety anymore. So we're trying to it's like putting together a puzzle without the box or even a real sense of what the image is on the inside of it, right? That's what we're trying to do. That was really long. Mark, what did you have? Was it the dragon?
Okay. The sun comes from the 12 tribes.
Yep.
And then goes to the throne while the 12 tribes are.
Excellent. Sorry.
No, it's okay. I was going to make a comment about the mikvah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Good. You got it. Yep. Good. Excellent. Right. So mikvahs. Thank you for that. So mikvahs were the ancient Jewish antecedents, the precursor to what become our baptismal fonts. And they were built in much the same fashion that Mark's talking about. So mikvahs were ritual baths for the Jews for those times when you became so ritually unclean that time and particular sacrifices wouldn't suffice. And so there were some ways of becoming unclean that were done without a mikvah, some that could only be done with a mikvah, and some that could be done kind of by the wars. And I say were, but I should be saying are, because this is still a practice amongst Orthodox Jews. The synagogue on Cummins Parkway put one in that then everybody was using, and then they closed, and I'm not actually sure where it landed. But this is a real thing, and Jewish, it's funny, right? So Jewish purity laws are clearly something that at times gets Jesus very agitated, right? He's not always real happy about it. And at the same time, the primary and initiating symbol for Jesus' own people becomes this one great bath. So instead of washing yourself 1,000 times every time you go to do something, there's one bath that makes you spiritually clean, sort of for goodsies, as it were. But but that winds up is drawing on the same tradition, is drawing on the same imagery, but is different, is consciously doing something different than either the mikveh or the ritual pots and pans and washing bowls. I'm gonna move just so we can get stuff, but again, write things down. I want all of this eventually. I just want the biggest of the symbols to be clear today. All right, so we move from there. Woman with the dragon. I'm not skipping verses at this point. We're just going straight through the book, right? And then war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. The dragon and his angels fought back, but they were defeated. And there was no longer any place for them in heaven. The great dragon was thrown down, the ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down from the earth, and his angels thrown down with him. All right. What do we see there? What do we think?
It's out of order.
Okay, good.
Because this is taking place after the birth of Christ, when it happened back in creation time.
Wait, this is like before anything else we read, right?
Right.
Yeah, good. Good. What else? So, again, drawing on imagery that is already familiar to the audience, right? So the great dragon, that ancient serpent, who is called both the devil and Satan. So, again, multivalent symbol, a symbol with multiple meanings. So the same entity, same guy in this very new sense, same entity, right, having more than one name, being both a dragon and also a serpent, cast down. He has angels, okay? And this is, again, this is angel both like in the species sense and in the function sense. Because what's an angel? A messenger. So he's got these messengers, these minions that work for him, right? And how many are cast down?
A third.
Mm.
So again, this question of the third. It's enough that it matters, but it's not like it's better than half. So a whole bunch, but not all. Something like that. And this whole kind of martial imagery. Now I picked this icon in particular. What do we see up here that is familiar? What's he holding?
Trumpet.
He's got a trumpet.
Spear.
Okay. He's got a spear. What's kind of floating up in the air on the left there?
Yeah. Is it a chalice?
No, it's a good guess. There's smoke coming out of it.
Okay.
It's the incense, right? So remember we saw him with the incense last week?
Yep.
In a book, right? So, and again, artistic representation is never going to be exactly the same from the text. I get it. I'm not trying to canonize any one image, right? But this does helpfully tie the angel as we've seen him earlier in the book with this very precise action, which is the one we probably more frequently associate with him. Now we typically refer to this character as, like after Mass each day, how do we address him?
Saint Michael.
Is he a saint?
He's an angel.
He's an angel.
Angels aren't saints.
Okay, so why do we call him Saint Michael?
Saint just means holy.
Okay, good. So this is a feature of, it's a feature of language, and specifically of how English works now, as opposed to how Latin and Greek worked before. So saint does just mean holy. It's a sort of nominative form of holy. So like, holy E. Cafe or something like that is basically what we're saying when we call someone a saint. Hagia Sophia, Holy Wisdom, the Greek church in Constantinople, it would be like saying, well, Holy Tonys. We say that ironically now, but that is kind of what you the way you would be referring to your churches sort of historically is Holy Agnes, Holy Felicitas, Holy Perpetuals, Holy whatever. So when we call Saint Michael, Saint Michael, we're not making him into a person, or we're not like transpeciating or something. That's not the
idea. He was never canonized.
No. Yeah, that's right. And it would be, and you know, you wouldn't want to be on the, you wouldn't want to be the devil's advocate in that canonization process.
What does Michael mean? You know.
Oh, the name? Yeah. So Mikael, so that L at the end is it means God. And when I say means God, this is very important.
It literally means the word God, which, so Elohim means gods or God in the plural. But that gets confusing because God, the God of Israel, is referred to as Elohim at times in the Old Testament. In the same sort of way that in Spanish and many other Romance languages, you wind up referring to somebody who's your superior or who's more important than you in the plural, or like people would speak in the royal we, right? So you've got here. So that at times the im winds up referring to the gods. He's frequently referred to as the God of gods. That's a pretty ordinary way that God's referred to in the Psalms. This is not making exactly a claim about like the existence of pagan gods. We're going to hit that hard next week, so I'm not going to deep dive that today. But it's recognizing God's sort of place in the thing. The reason that's important, that El as part of the name is always, the rest of the name is then going to have to relate directly back to God. So Michael, Raphael, Gabriel, Uriel, okay? So these are all agents of God in particular ways. So Raphael pertains to God's healing and sort of comfort. The word's a little bit obscure, but that's where that's coming from. Gabriel has to do with like messaging and communication. And Mikael is a double entendre. So it's a multivalent word symbol. It literally means who is like God. But it's unclear if this is a question or like a cheer. Is it Michael saying, who is like God? Like, Satan, you big dummy, nobody's that good. That kind of thing, right? So a rhetorical question. Or is it, who is like our God, who shall reign on high? Braveheart kind of thing, right? So its meaning is a bit ambiguous. But it's very, very important that the names that are given to the named angels pertain to their function. Because the angels and what they do are inseparable in a way that the earthly creatures and what they do typically are not, right? So, you know, Reggie, plays, like he likes to lick. He occasionally fetches, less occasionally brings it back. He eats, he drinks, he poops, he cuddles, right? But none of those things are precisely him. And whatever he is more than just the combination. You could make a machine that would do all those things, and it still wouldn't accomplish what the thing is that the beast is, right? But angels are a bit different because their relationship to their function is like, this is an analogy. It's an analogy that couldn't exist in the first century. It's baked into their DNA. They don't have DNA, right? But like the whatness of what they are is tied up with what God has assigned for them to do. Now, it may well be that the same is true for us in ways we can't see yet. Open to that correction. But that's what's going on with the names.
So is that the same also for angels that fell?
So often, though usually, this is harder to see in English, and I haven't deep dived it with Greek, but I know that in Hebrew, they alter the ending so that L's often become LF's in order to indicate like past tense. But I'm not going to pretend to know whether that's entirely universal or whether there are exceptions, but it's a good question. Okay. So, again, I'm just trying to get us through so we have the big ideas here. We can come back to any one of these next week, I promise. So then, after the war, I heard a loud voice in heaven proclaiming, and now we have another song. And this is the song, we sing this every week in the office too, right? Now salvation and power come, the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Messiah, for the accuser of our, actually, so it's saying Messiah there, literally anointed. The authority of his anointed. And that notion of anointing is important because seals are real significant throughout the book, right? We have the seals on the blessed last week. We're going to see seals of another thing in just a minute. For the accuser, the accuser, whose name means accuser? Okay. The accuser of our comrades or brethren has been cast down, thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God, but they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they did not cling to life even in the face of death. Rejoice therefore, you heavens, and those that dwell therein, but woe to the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you with great wrath, because he knows that his time is short. Okay, so who are we singing about? They did not cling to life even in the face of death. They have conquered by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. The martyrs. The martyrs. So the martyrs are those who have conquered by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their own testimony. They didn't cling to life even in the face of death. So somehow or other, whatever else is going on with all these symbols, very, very clearly, the author of the book of Revelation is speaking to a time and a situation in which the church is facing real persecution and actual people are dying for the faith. And so at least one of the questions that this author is trying to answer is, how do we make sense of everything Jesus did if now we're all getting killed for it? I thought we were getting a better deal than this. This doesn't seem like the right sort of operation. So weirdly, he's insisting not only, like, is this an okay thing, they're singing about it. They're commanding creation to rejoice that people were willing to die for it. And that they conquered, not only, they conquered both by the act of Jesus, by the blood of the Lamb, and by something they did. So they're participating in the own act which saves them. Okay? And of course, songs keep showing up over and over. All right. The dragon fights again. So when the dragon saw that he had been thrown down to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. But the woman was given the two wings of a great eagle so that she could fly from the serpent into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time, and times at half a time. And then from his mouth the serpent poured water like a river after the woman to sweep her away with the flood. But the earth came to the help of the woman. It opened its mouth and swallowed the river that the dragon had poured forth from its mouth. And then the dragon was angry with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her children. This is another indicator that at least on some level, this is not Mary, but is likely the church. Jesus, the firstborn of many brothers and sisters, right? Those who keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus. So these characters do more than one thing, and they seem to be meaning or indicating more than one thing based on the thing that they're doing. What do you see there, either in the text or in the picture? It's hard to draw this stuff, right? Like, where do you put the other head?
Who is Mary lifting Jesus up to?
So the child gets spirited away, right? And so that's kind of what you're supposed to be seeing here.
That's what that is.
And then this is her once she's retired to the wilderness for the time. But again, it's an artist looking at the text and trying to draw something like what we're seeing.
Yeah. Before I thought that the wilderness was maybe out of context, you know. But maybe it's her trip to Egypt.
Egypt. So you're not the first to propose that. There's something to it. I think what's, like, again, I want us to resist the temptation to make these things simply this or that. Like, it can be this and that, maybe that other thing, and probably something we haven't thought yet. Right, that's the nature of these symbols. It's not that they can mean anything. That would be a mistake here, right? So, again, the flag represents those noble virtues that I mentioned before. For us, there are parts of the world that flag means a very different thing and would be associated with
different values or disvalues. But what they're not going to do is just then, like, the color blue now, instead of meaning loyalty, means infidelity or something, right? Those would be contradictory notions, and that would make the symbol unintelligible. And so it's possible for the woman to be associated with the Virgin, and it's possible for the woman to be associated with the Church, and it's possible for the woman to be associated with Israel, and it's possible for them to be all three. How? Well, the Church already is the new Israel. There's already a parity between Israel and the Church. That's the whole symbolic dynamism of the Church. 12 tribes, 12 apostles, ruling on 12 thrones. That's why you have 24 elders, right? So, okay. Well, then what about Mary? Well, Mary is the first of the disciples. In some ways, the firstborn of the Church. Which is why she's called Mother of the Church, right? So she's the queen of the saints because she's the first saint, which means then she's the first in the Church. So she's not over and against the Church. It's not is the Church or is Mary. It's both in different ways and at different times. Most of us probably operate on this score in our human lives all the time, right? Like, you're both your mom to your kids, but your aunt to your nieces and nephews. Your relationship with your nieces and nephews is and probably should be somewhat different than your relationship with your kids. But there is a thing that we can call aunt that is real and is distinct from the thing we call mom. And one and the same person can evidence both, maybe at the same time, certainly at different times, right? I know when my mom died, all the cousins came, and at the wake, they were all telling stories, and my sister and I were looking at each other, and we're going, is this the same lady? Anything else, at least initially, on this one? Yeah, so they're referring to, it's an ambiguity in the Greek about the period of time. So sometimes you'll see a year, and then another half a year, but it's not actually clear that it's a year that's being said there. The word is where we get epoch from. And so that actually suggests perhaps a much longer period of time, but it's just ambiguous is the honest answer. I could try and make something up, which is what people usually do with this book. Yeah.
Is the image of the serpent pouring water on her to wipe her out an image of, like, Noah and the flood?
Yeah. So the waters are important, both here. Yeah. So yes, the answer to your question is, the language here is deliberately borrowing from flood imagery, and it's kind of like, because who causes the Noah's flood? God causes Noah's flood. That's not who's the actor here. And so what you wind up seeing, just like we saw with the sevens, sort of faking creation. Sort of, now we've got disasters. We've got Satan tries to ape God. He tries to imitate poorly the kind of things that God does. God sends a flood to try and destroy all the bad people on the earth. Satan's going to send a flood to try and destroy the good person on the earth, right? And the flood imagery comes back with her in just a minute. It becomes clearer in a minute. But yes, you're anticipating rightly. Right, anything else there? Okay. This is probably the wildest image. This is like a 10-year-old's dream or something, right?
Yeah.
And then I saw a beast rising out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and on its horns were 10 diadems, and on its heads were blasphemous names. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard, its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And the dragon gave it his power and the throne and great authority. And one of its heads seemed to have received a death blow, but its mortal wound had been healed. In amazement, the whole earth followed the beast. They worshiped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast? Who can fight against it?" So what do we see here? Apart from weird dino, leopard, lion.
With that end bit, it is like a, because with Satan gaping at God, the comments like gaping Michael, if you're down,
Beautiful. Excellent.
And it says that the beast is wounded, and then that its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth followed the beast.
Mm-hmm. So who does that aid?
Jesus.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. What's this about worship?
Following evil or following?
What's that?
Following evil?
Yeah, I mean, certainly that. I mean, it seems to indicate more, though, than just like, this isn't just like telling fibs, right? Like, so the act of worship is intentional, right? You can't like whoopsadoodle stumble into idolatry. So like when we worship in spirit and truth in the context of the liturgy, like we are consciously and seriously trying to do a thing, right? When the Jews worshiped in the temple, they would travel days to get there to pray in a very particular way in this very particular place, right? So they worshiped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast, and they worship the beast, who is like, saying, who is like the beast and who can fight against it. So much the same way that you've got this multiple imagery on the Jesus side. So you've got the lamb, who at times appears like a lion, and who also is a baby boy, and sometimes a man with white hair, all of which are hanging on a throne. So you have a beast and a dragon, distinct but relating to each other, and they're receiving the same worship, which is clearly not their due, but that's what they're trying to like get, right? And one of them, or one of the heads, right, appears to have died and come back to life, right? It's received a mortal blow but survived. So it's all playing off of this Christ anti-Christ imagery. I'm kind of blowing later, but that's okay. Try and get out of your head the notion of the Antichrist as a singular character. There is a singular character that's going to show up who gets referred to this way, but Antichrist is simply a noun that's used all over the Johannine literature. So St. John uses it in the letters too, and it simply refers to somebody who does stuff the opposite way of Jesus stuff. And so like one who receives the worship due to God alone, who is not Christ, would clearly be anti-Christ, right? Who in the ancient world received worship like a god?
Caesar's.
Nero.
Okay, so hold on to that. That's what's behind at least a lot of this. Not necessarily all of it, because it's
Father, what was your question?
Huh?
What was your question?
So who received worship like a god in the ancient world? And the answer was Caesar.
Okay.
So the Roman emperors were eventually worshipped as gods, and certainly by the time of Nero. We'll see more about that in a minute. But there is a clear concern here about worship. This is a needle tipping sort of thing. Mark?
No, I just want to confuse because it says one of his heads seems to have received death.
Well.
I can understand, but its mortal wound had been healed.
Mm-hmm.
And in amazement to the whole earth, followed the beast. Okay, now, they worship the dragon. Who's the? For he had given.
You're trying to do one to one. This is why I asked you not to do that.
Oh.
Like that, it's not this or that.
Okay.
It's not this or that. It's both of these things together. So just as we had both the things together before, you have both these things together now. But it's not these things together with the things before, right? Those would become.
Okay.
You see the move, and that's why. It's like we had with the locusts and the helicopters last week. Like, okay, well, it looks like a locust, and as much as it's got wings and it flits around, but it has a human face because there's a guy looking out the window. That is not what this is for, right? That's a gross misreading of the text. Yeah.
I when they talk about the beast, is you know where it's coming from? It's mm-hmm. rising out of the sea. So I don't. quite know what to do.
Why the sea? So we raised the question about Noah and the flood. How did that's all right, but you just made a flood. let's hope no beast pops up out of the table. Why was the flood scary? So it ruined everything. What lived in the waters? What was left in the waters after everything got destroyed? Monsters. There be dragons, right? Literal monsters. So the sea, right? In the beginning, you've got this formless chaos. And the very first thing we have is the separation of water and dry land. You have light and dark and water and dry land. And these are set at opposites on purpose. Why? Because water without light is especially dark, right? It's super murky. The Jews were not generally a seafaring people. They fished, but the Sea of Galilee is okaboji overblown, right? This is not the Mediterranean, right? And so you don't have days long fishing voyages or something like that. This is not how they operated. What lived in the sea was nothing that you wanted. And so to have a beast come from the sea is sort of like rising up out of chaos, rising out of the primal murky murk, rising out of the gunky stuff. And the flood is the greatest sign of that, right? So the flood is what happens when the whole world is chaos, when the whole world is covered and all that's left is monsters except the eight people on the boat who wind up mysteriously saved by water, which becomes a type of baptism, right? So they're in the boat, but the only reason that they're able to be saved in the boat is because the water itself lifts them and moves them to the mountain where the boat comes to rest. So it, again, one symbol carrying multiple meanings. I'm gonna blitz just so that we can make sure we get the stuff in. I'm serious, write down any questions. I'm not trying to blow off. I just wanna make sure we get, yeah.
So the rest of that one, the rest of it,
uh-huh.
It says, and the beast was given a mouth, then it starts to sound like it's anti. See, I've got more than that.
Where are you at? Where are we looking at?
Okay, I've got the against it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next paragraph says, and the beast was given a mouth, uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 years. Oh, okay.
You're just anticipating me, that's fine. Great minds think alike. It opens its mouth to utter blasphemies. Keep reading.
Oh, where are we? I'm
it's okay if your translation is so
bad. Exercise authority for 42 months.
Uh-huh.
It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Do you want me to keep going?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Also was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. It was given authority over every tribe and people and language and nation, and all the inhabitants of the earth will worship it. Everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb that was slaughtered.
Okay. So, talk through that. What do we think it means?
It's almost like we're talking about two different things, because in the first one, it refers to Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this beast is obviously.
Right, so you've got type, anti-type, right? These things set at opposites. Good. What about this blasphemy thing? What is blasphemy? We act like we know this, but maybe we don't.
The Lord's name in vain.
So that's the thing we're most familiar with it. The danger with that is, and part of this is a feature of English, but it makes it sound like saying, oh my God, is somehow gonna cause the end of the world. And that's stupid. Here's the reason that's stupid. Apropos of the earlier question about St. Michael's name, God is not God's name. So what makes, oh my God,
an inappropriate interjection is not the use of the word God, it's the use of the word my. Because you're now making clear who it is you're swearing by, and you really shouldn't be doing that for something like stubbing your toe. You know, it's sort of like if I stub my toe and I say, God damn it! Oh, it's scary, Father just said a naughty word. What's naughty about that? God damn it, it's all over the Bible. God actually damns people left, right, and center. You're about to see him damn about half the planet. So that can be what's wrong with it. So what's wrong with stubbing my toe and saying God damn it? But what is it about the curse? What is it about the curse that makes it bad? Right, so God doesn't damn chairs. He might damn priests who aren't careful with their tongue, but he doesn't damn chairs, and he certainly doesn't do it just because I say it, right? So what makes something blasphemous isn't simply like inappropriate use of language. That may well be a sin for other reasons. It's a fair question, like what swearing is and that sort of thing. And English makes this very complicated because the bulk of our really bad swears are like scatological and sexual, whereas in the other Romance languages, the really bad swears are all blasphemous. So if you go to Quebec and you want to drop an F-bomb, you don't say the F-word. You say tabernacle, but with a really bad French accent. Because what you're doing is swearing by the one who is in the tabernacle. So you're calling on the Holy One to witness to something that's not holy at all. So these blasphemies aren't simply, these are not, you know, the people that are being proposed here are not your ethical atheist neighbor, or even your devout Hindu at work or something, right? This is a conscious inversion of God's name, God's power, God's presence, right? And that's what blasphemy does. So it's the reason that when people want to be offensive against the faith, they'll, you know, pee on a statue of the Virgin, or they'll break into a church and they'll make a mess on the altar, or they'll bust open the tabernacle and desecrate the sacrament. Because what you're doing is you're taking the holy thing and you're like unholyizing it, is the idea. Okay? So if holiness is the quality that's proper to God and the things of God, so the things and people that draw closest to God are rightly called holy, is a sort of title that attaches to them, then what blasphemy does is accomplish unholiness. It not only rejects whatever holiness could be proper to the person or the entity to begin with, but it sort of establishes the opposite. So where was virtue, now is vice. Where was grace, now is misery. Right? It's again a sort of a play of opposites. So it opened its mouth and utters blasphemies. We'll come back to the 42 months. Again, the number thing, we'll do all the numbers next week. Next week will be math. It opened its mouth, uttered blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name. And of course, God's name is in and attached to the temple, right? And this all started when we saw the temple opened and the ark come forth. That's kind of what triggered all of this to start off with, right? So he blasphemes against God, against his name and his dwelling. But his dwelling now is not the temple, but those who dwell in it. God's dwelling is with the human race. Okay, God's now in the people and not in the space. This is very different. Like, no pious Jew in the first century would have thought God was in him in the way that we would maintain is in us and in the church specifically, right? So God dwells in those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to make war on the saints. Now, that sounds redundant. So if he's making war on those in heaven, who are these saints now? And to conquer them?
The people that are being persecuted for the faith?
And here, right?
On earth.
Because if it's even possible for them to be conquered, they're clearly not in the place of victory, right? So it's a more archaic use of the word saint. But it is entirely true. The Bible uses the word saint both to refer to dead people and to living people. This is a clear indication of living people. It was given authority over every tribe and language and people and nation. That should sound real familiar. The first hymn, way back in chapter 3 or 4, this is what was given to Jesus, to the Lamb. The Lamb on the throne was given authority over every people and language and nation and way of life. And so they repeat the same language here to show Christ,
Ansi, Christ, Ansi, right? And all the inhabitants of the earth will worship it, and everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb that was slaughtered. Ooh. That's spooky sound. What's that sound like?
What does the 42 months mean?
I'm going to hold it. I'm not trying to be a jerk, but I want the number thing will make a lot more sense when I have the whole chart up. It's trying to establish a definite period of time. Like, that is what it's trying to do. But beyond that, and how long would 42 months be?
Okay.
Right, 3.5 years, something like that. So it's significant. This wasn't a fly-by-night kind of thing. And you can see why it then gets easy. But you can see why the temptation is so right. Who was president for 3.5 years?
Yeah.
Right? If you do the one-to-one thing, it's always going to wind up resulting in that sort of thing.
What was your question again?
So the question was about the 42 months. Like, just
no,
what does it
I mean, your question before that, you asked something.
That's a great question. What does the Book of Life sound like? And everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb that was slaughtered. Which is kind of a twister.
144,000. Were they supposed to be written in the book of life?
So the names of the 144,000 are inscribed in the book of life. It's not clear earlier on if they're the only ones or just we're certain that those are ones. But yes. So 144,000, and it's not just the book of life, like full stop, it's the book of life of the Lamb that was slaughtered, or that was slain, right? It is worth noting, right, this language of book of life does contrast with a thing very familiar for ancient peoples, less familiar for us. What would the opposite of the book of life be? The book of death, or the book of the dead. So probably the most famous Book of the Dead, like if you walk into Barnes & Noble or something, is going to be from Tibet, the Tibetan Book of the Dead. It's actually in India, but the Tibetans kept it. Mummies were often wrapped in what was called the Book of Life. So this is not clear to most of us, but when you see a mummy, especially an Egyptian-style mummy, which is what the Jews knew, there are two mummies in the Old Testament. Anybody know who they are?
Lazarus.
It's a good guess, not true though, because if he was mummified, it would have been real hard to come back to life. Jacob and Joseph were told were buried after the manner of the Egyptians, and then their remains are brought back into Israel when they come. But that's an aside, it doesn't really matter. When the Egyptians would wrap, all of that linen that the people were wrapped in was written on. But the writing's on the inside, not on the outside. So you can't see it. So when you see me wrapped up like a mummy, the toilet paper, right? All you can see is the outside. But the inside has been written on. And what was written on the inside of the mummy wrappings, was the Egyptian Book of the Dead. And it was particular, like, imprecations that the dead person was supposed to say when they got to the other world that was supposed to keep them safe and... it was like an amulet to protect them as they got. And the idea was that when you got to the other side, you would literally sort of start to unwrap yourself. And as you unwrapped yourself, you would be saying these prayers. And then by the time you got done, you'd be alive again, right? But so they're playing off of this kind of thing on purpose. And it's death and life imagery. So you were doing opposites again. But the life here is tied to the Lamb that was slain. So there was a move for a while, I can remember this when I was a kid, like the funeral book at the parish was just called the Book of Life. And like you would write, you know, Granny Smith's name in the Book of Life at the parish or something. This is extremely presumptuous. People don't ever do that. Don't put my name in something that says Book of Life. I don't know if I'm in there. Let him do it. His signature I trust. But be careful about that. It also misunderstands what's going on here. So the idea is not God's got a library in heaven that he was lounging in before he created the world, and that there's a book on the top shelf that's called the Book of Life, and in that book, if one were able to get on a high shelf and pull it off, you would just have the names of all the people that were ever going to be saved. That's not the notion here. There is some thought, I don't know that I buy this, but it's worth mentioning, there are some scholars who actually think that what this refers to is the Gospels. Whatever written Gospels were already extant at the time of the people that would have heard this, because it is the book of life of the Lamb that was slain. Well, whose is the book of the life of the Lamb that was slain? The Gospels, mm-hmm. Right? And so it's a grammatical ambiguity. Also important to know, there's virtually no punctuation in ancient Greek. So it is at times when you're reading the ancient manuscripts, it's hard to tell where you're supposed to start and where you're supposed to stop. Yeah?
When it comes to the 144,000 in heaven, I know that just is a symbol. I had a friend of mine, though, after, I don't know what her source was, she said, you know, there's only 144,000 people in heaven. I said, that's a good word. And boy, I could not address her.
So, your friend has unfortunately not read the book of Revelation very carefully, because when we were introduced to the 144,000, we were also introduced to a great multitude. So it's 144,000, it is minimally 144,000 plus 24, because you've got the 24 elders that are also there with 144,000. So it's really 144,024. And then you've got this multitude that starts off on earth, but then they're singing in heaven, so it appears they got there somehow. What we talked about before, I don't remember if this was last week or the week before. So the people that have really landed hard on the 144,000 thing are the Jehovah's Witnesses. And they at least try and put their money where their mouth is, right? So what I said, I know some of you already heard this. So the 144,000 are those that have been sealed on the forehead. And so the way the Jehovah's Witnesses sort of mark this is they only practice Holy Communion once a year. They only do it in particular places, so it's not like every local kingdom hall is going to have one. Usually they gather like statewide or something. But only about a tenth of the people that show up present themselves to receive. And so last year, about 20,000 people, 22,000 people, I think, received communion at the one communion service the Jehovah's Witnesses did all around the world at the same time. The reason the Jehovah's Witnesses have this vision is because they take those first four chapters very, very literally, and what they see is the 144,000 are those who wind up in heaven, in the new heavens and the new earth, and then everybody who's not part of the 144,000 but who is saved is on earth. But again, that great multitude wound up in heaven by the end of chapter 4, so I don't know why we're still talking about it. Okay. I know that there's more questions and it's good. I just want to make sure we hit like broad strokes so you see what's coming, okay? We have another beast. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but this beast comes out of the earth rather than out of the sea. And again, the relationship between the beasts, somewhat ambiguous. I saw another beast that rose out of the earth. It had two horns like a lamb and it spoke like a dragon. It exercises all authority of the first beast on its behalf, and it makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose mortal wound had been healed. Okay, so we're in continuity, but distinct, right? Performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in the sight of all. And by the signs that it is allowed to perform on behalf of the beast, it deceives the inhabitants of the earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that had been wounded by the sword and yet lived. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast so that the image of the beast could even speak and cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. Okay. Who did we say received worship in the first century? Caesar. What happens if you don't worship Caesar? You get killed. Now, symbols are multivalent. This doesn't necessarily only refer to that, but this would have to be the one thing everybody hearing this the first time is thinking about, because it's literally happening down the street, right? It would be like if in that year after September 11th, there was this vision of two towers
which exploded in a great fireball. We wouldn't have been able to think of anything else. That's the only thing that is still now, right? That's what it conjures up. So, also it causes all, both great and small, both rich and poor, free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell who does not have the mark. That is the name of the beast or the number of its name. Okay? We're going to do the number of the beast in just a minute. But right hand or forehead, so that no one can buy or sell who does not have the mark of the beast. In the ancient Roman Empire, post-Nero, up until sometime later, the way that this worked was the worship of Caesar was, this is anachronistic, but we'll get the point across, it was kind of paid with your income taxes. So you would go in to be assessed for your taxes. You'd have the tax that you're supposed to pay, so you'd go in to pay your taxes, and there would be a shrine set up to the emperor. And after you paid your taxes to the emperor, so kind of an offertory, right? Then you would pick up your pinch of incense and you would go say your prayer before the image or the icon of the emperor. Nobody believed the image was the emperor, but the image was clearly intended to represent the emperor. And if you burned incense before the image, you were saying, I burned incense before the one the image represents, and so I'm worshiping Caesar. Once you did that, now you're good for the year. You've paid your taxes, so you would get a receipt. Usually in the form of a coin. So not a piece of paper, but either a metal or clay coin that it would be like the tags on your car. It renews annually and shows that you're good to do the thing you're trying to do. In this case, buy and sell. So it would be like having a license to run a food stall or something like that, right? Or a license to engage in commerce. One incentive for doing this is when travelers would come in from outside of the empire or outside of the region that you're in, they would have to pay a kind of an entrance tax. They wouldn't have to offer the incense, but they'd have to pay the entrance tax to be able to do commerce in the place, okay? So he's playing off of this well-established, normal, civil practice that everybody that he's hearing has to do, and that if you don't do this thing, you don't get the license to practice business. How easy is it going to be to live if you can't buy or sell anything?
Tough.
Real tough, right? This is way before prepper. You're all on your own. Okay. And what is on this is the name of the beast. Like a coin. Whose image is on the coin?
Caesar.
This calls for wisdom. Let anyone with understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a person, and its number is 666. All right, this is the one number I'm going to allow for the day. Okay? Yeah, Mark, what you got?
Didn't they find that there was also the 616?
Everybody's jumping in all day. Yes, absolutely. That is exactly where I'm going. Okay, the mark of the beast, the number of the beast. So what is this? It either has to do with heads or hands. Now this is interesting, especially for Jews, because what would go on your head or your wrist? The prayer, right? So the Shema is what would be written and put in a box on your forehead and on your right hand. And so you're displacing God. That's the fundamental thing. You're displacing God. And practically, what is this? Okay, so we've got all the different imaginary things that this could be. Actual tattoo, if you're watching a fundamentalist horror movie. A microchip, if you're on conspiracy theory websites. Other tattoo, I don't know if you're in a 50s comic book. Honestly, it's not clear what they're doing up there, but they're receiving a mark on the forehead, right? So what is this mark? What Mark McCormick, not the mark. The mark of the beast. What Mark McCormick was asking about was there are textual variations in early manuscripts, some of which show 666 and some of which show 616. But both are important for the following reason. Okay. So this is called gematria.
which is the practice of reading letters for numbers and vice versa. In the ancient world, most languages used the same marks for letters as for numbers. So they were, this is not technically true because they weren't all alphabets. Alphabet, by the way, just comes from the Greek alpha, beta, right? But not all ancient languages worked off of letters the way that we do. A lot of them were whole word languages. But either way, what you all had Roman numerals in school, so you at least get this part. The letter I equals the number 1. 2 I's equal the number 2. 3 I's equal 3. But for 4, you don't have 4 I's. What do you have? An I before the V. What do you have for 6?
V,
then I. Okay. So you can see there's a pattern. It's not the pattern we're all most familiar with. We don't do our numbers this way. But it's not crazy. Like, there's just a different way of sequencing the marks. Okay. But that letter I, in Latin, functions more or less, I mean, it doesn't mean the first person singular pronoun, but apart from that, it functions like the letter I does in English. It represents the I sound, right? Okay. So it's both a sound and a number. Hebrew operates on the same principle, but it does it differently. So it starts with Aleph, which is more or less equivalent to Alpha, or A, then Bet, or Beta, 2, and it does that all the way up to the number 10. And then after the number 10, it starts counting by tens. So then it goes from 10, 20, 30, 40, until you hit 100. And then when you hit 100, you get 100, 200, 300, 400, and then that's all the letters. So, but practically speaking, what they would do is something like what the Romans would do with the before and after piece, but you would just use it using 10 or using 100. It was a base 10 system that way. All right. John, this is the contemporary thought. There's a number of different ways of getting there, but it's all pointing to Mark's greater point. John wrote in Greek, but thought and spoke in Hebrew. This is assuming John's the author of Revelation. We can argue about that later. But whoever wrote this is playing with this stuff because there's no other way to get a name out of numbers. There's no obvious way to get a name out of numbers. If you take Neron Kyrios, Nero Caesar, then you wind up with, this is it in Hebrew, 50 plus 200 plus 6 plus 50. Plus 100 plus 60 plus 200, which equals 666. If you take the N off of Nero, which is the way that he was usually referred to but was not his proper name, then you get 616. And so the fact that there are two variant textual traditions that both point to the same person is a pretty good indicator that you're dealing with this person. And of course, why was Nero important? He's the emperor that started persecuting the Christians. Up until then, the persecutions were real, but they were localized and they were carried out more by the Jewish community who were concerned about us than by the Roman officials. Nero is the one who starts the persecution of the church on a kind of imperial level, not a kind of, on an actually imperial level. But there's more. Now, this comes from slightly later in the text. This is the coin that I was talking about before that would give you your business license. So that you couldn't trade that for money. It's like a driver's license, right? In a bit, what we'll see next week, we learn more about the beast. Here is the mind which hath wisdom. 7 heads are the 7 mountains on which the woman sits. We'll meet the woman in a minute. And there are 7 kings. 5 have fallen. 1 is, the other has yet to come. The 7 heads and the 7 hills are largely associated with Rome. There is another claimant that we'll talk about next week, but that's the big idea. Rome. 5 have fallen, 1 is, and 1 will come and be for a little while. You have Caesar, Julius Caesar the first. Just in case you didn't realize this, if you cover up the C part here, this is where you get the word czar. So the Russians didn't invent it. So the Russians thought themselves as the third Roman Empire. So you have Julius, Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, Nero. Okay, so you have 5 who are dead. Nero, who is, at least potentially. And then 1 who will come only for a little while, who is Galba. And Galba's the emperor that follows Nero, and he's only in office 7 months. So I would say at this point in Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodox circles, this is the dominant read. It's not the only one. It's not an article of faith. This isn't like the Assumption. If you don't buy it, you're not a bad Catholic. But this is the reason that it's become the dominant kind of piece. This one's very, very specific. This is probably the most specific thing, like, in the book. Most of the rest of these are deliberately ambiguous. But assuming for a moment that this is true, and that the author of the book of Revelation, John Smith or John Jones or whoever John is, assuming that he is writing this during or immediately after the reign of Nero, what would be the danger in putting Nero's name in text?
Oh, no, it had to be code.
You see the problem? So if he puts the, like, if there's ambiguity, there's plausible deniability. But if he just says, you know, Nero is the opposite of our God, or the empire is opposed to Jesus or something, he's not just murdering himself, the whole community gets wiped out, right? So there's terrific incentive to write in some species of code. All right, the last thing I'm gonna do, and I'm sorry, because I know today's been kind of nutty, but I promise next week it'll make the whole thing worth it, is we have the great whore of Babylon and the beast. And this is where that last bit sort of ultimately came from. Then one of the seven angels who had had the seven bowls came to me and said, come, and I will show you the judgment of the great whore who is seated on many waters, which is the language that Genesis uses to refer to the flood, the many waters, the multitude of waters. With whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and with the wine of whose fornication the inhabitants of the earth have become drunk. So he carried me away in spirit to the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had seven heads and ten horns, again with the heads and the horns. The woman was clothed in purple and scarlet and adorned with golden jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her fornication, and on her forehead was written a name, a mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of whores and of earth's abominations. And I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the witnesses to Jesus. All right, so the last thing you have to play guesswork with today. What do we think is going on?
Like evil has been unleashed.
Evil is sort of unleashed and is like personified in all these different things, right? So she's, the fact that she's a whore and that there's all this emphasis on fornication and drunkenness, she's almost like fornication incarnate, right? It's like a person, it's like personalizing thing, right? And what's going on? He carried me away in the wilderness, and I saw her sitting on a scarlet beast full of blasphemous names. And what would, how could an animal be full of names? Tattooed? So what, just on a basic level, like what would it look like the author's trying to point us to there? The author's trying to point us to it. Sorry, my collar keeps moving. I apologize. So, you know, earlier on we've seen seals or names either written on foreheads or sealed on foreheads or put on hands, right? So what does having somebody's name on you do?
Ownership.
Ownership. Claim. Right? We brand cattle or hogs, right? So that we can tell who they belong to. It was common in the ancient world to brand slaves in this way. If a slave escaped and was free for a year and a day,
So if they didn't get caught in the first year in the day of the empire, then they were set free, which is the reason that novitiates for monasteries historically are a year and a day. It's a relic that goes all the way back. But it's because if the guy managed to sneak into the monastery and his master not find out, and the abbot could hold him for a whole year, then the master couldn't steal him back out. But it's a claim of ownership, of tie, of identity, right? So we wear the jersey of our favorite team to show that we're affiliated with the team. Never played for them, but sure gonna cheer, that kind of thing, right?
And the beast holds the names.
So, again, not probably going to be super useful to look for one-to-one correspondence with each of these, or like this horn represents this, and this horn represents that, and this, right? That's not. But, on the whole, you see sort of what's going on here. Are these good characters or bad characters?
Bad.
Yeah, good. If you said good, that'd be a problem. Okay, so these are the bad guys in the story, and they have an important sort of job to fulfill. Mark, what you got? They're Angie, sorry.
Thinking about the clothing. So purple and scarlet and golden jewels, that's like royalty. Mm-hmm. So is that also about hero and...
Yes, exactly. So this is pointing to royalty, and in fact, the question of like what makes royalty literally comes up in the next set of verses, but we're not gonna get there today. One thing that's important, purple, and this is important even just for your ears the next couple of weeks, listen close in the hymns we sing at the end of Lent. So, both in reality and also in language, the relationship between these colors and that color has been historically difficult. So we still have in English, it's somewhat rare, but it shows up in some of the hymns that we've got coming, which is the reason I was thinking about it. The verb to purple literally means to make red. So like, if you twist somebody and you're able to make something go purple, it turns red is what actually happens, right? And it's because the dyes that were used to make purple and scarlet were rare and came from many of the same places and the same things. And so at one point, the color of the empire just was scarlet. Initially, it was reserved to the emperor, and then it was anybody attached to the emperor, which is why in the movies you always see scarlet capes, right? That it meant they were hit. It was like the name thing. You're wearing his colors. You're part of his team. Later on, purple was added to distinguish the emperor from the rest, but everybody else who represented the empire still wore red. So soldiers wore red. The Senate, they couldn't wear red togas, but they could have red trim on their togas, which indicated that they were senators, they belonged to the empire, but they weren't part of the army, which is, of course, that's why the empire really gets established, right, is to create the Senate as distinct from the army. So the reason this matters here is because she's wearing both...
purple and scarlet.
Ah, she's got both. And so there's a royalty thing going on, and a martial thing going on. Mm-hmm. And, of course, if you don't get your license to practice and you do get caught, who is it that sees you to the amphitheater, to the lions? The soldiers. There's not some separate police force in ancient Rome. It's soldiers that are literally taking you to your death. In fact, right, what happens with Perpetua and Felicity from today is that one of the soldiers is so moved by seeing these two women's bravery in the face of martyrdom, he allows himself to be killed right alongside them. So, but of course that only happened because he was actually there.
Okay, so it says seated on many waters. So is that going back to the flood? And so she is indicative of the whole world at that time. And it all gets destroyed.
So, right, at the end of the last bit, well, that received a bit, but right, so the whole world has already begun to fall, right, and it starts to worship badly. I'm skipping through the seven bowls because we're going to look at those with our numerology section next week. But yes is the short answer, right? So the world begins to fall to the worship of the false god,
or the worship of the beast. And now you have this woman right in, seemingly a different beast, but again, the relationship between these beasts, much like the relationship between the lamb and the lion and the man, right? They're distinct somehow, but they're related somehow, right? And she's representing all of this. You've got the martial and the royal. You've got sort of wealth, sort of just as such. You've got sexual impurity. You've got drunkenness, right? I find a vice. She got it. She's in charge of it. She knows somebody can get it for you. You probably don't know somebody kind of like that. But, and what is she drunk with?
The blood
of the saints and of the witnesses to Jesus. So the blood of the martyrs. She's drunk on the blood of the martyrs. What is that a parallel of?
Today.
Think literally here. She's drunk on the blood of the martyrs. What do we get drunk on?
Yeah.
Him, right? So, but again, it's aping, right? She's taking the sacred sign and making it something ugly and gross and blasphemous. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So with the aping, like you're talking about, she was in the wilderness, like the woman who was spirited away after the son. All the stuff that she's talking about are things that would make her ritually impure.
Yep. Excellent.
I'll stop.
No, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. No, he's hit it. And the key, kind of to remember for next week, is what's written on her forehead, this tide of Babylon. Remember, the book of Revelation at the end is deliberately kind of taking us full circle with stuff from the beginning. And the role of Babylon from the beginning and throughout the Old Testament. Just refresh us real quickly. Where do we first encounter Babylon?
The exile?
Way before that. They built a tower.
Oh, that's right.
Babylon.
That's why it's called Babylon. So it was the capital initially, right? So what book do we read about the Tower of Babylon? Genesis. So all the way back to the beginning. Babylon the Great, mother. Well, she was the mother of something, right? And what was wrong in Babylon?
They were trying to reach God or become God. And
see, so God does like short people. So the story of the Tower of Babel is not that God is against architecture, right? But it's about the hubris of the people who are trying to utilize human ingenuity to in some way or other overcome God or make themselves like God, right? It's a mythic story told in the same context. Mythic does not mean untrue. It just means that it's playing on certain kind of grammatical and narrative structures. But it's a story that's playing off of this grasping or reaching tendency, right? So reaching for the fruit, reaching up for heaven. Prometheus does the same sort of thing, right? He makes his wings fall. This is the same kind of idea. And so what you have is Babylon the Great. Now you say mother of whores, but that just sounds like a normal insult. Like that probably gets said in every bar of the night. Right? There's something more than that happening here, right? This is about a sort of origin story. So what's going on here, and I think this is probably the mistake that we moderns tend to make most often when looking at the book. We tend to look at this book and think, this is a book about the end of the world. The ancients, as they read it, and I would at least propose the guy as he wrote it, wasn't trying to answer, what does the movie of the end of the world look like? I think he was trying to answer, what do we do with all these questions from the very beginning? So from the very beginning, we have the problem of sin. And how is the problem of sin going to get resolved? From the very beginning, we have a problem with death as a result of sin. How does the problem of death get resolved? From the very beginning, creation itself winds up disordered because of the people living in it. How does the question of creation get resolved? And the answer to that is the end of the book of Revelation. So what I want you to do as best you can is for next week, read up through chapter 17. Any questions you have about numbers, symbols, characters? We've raised most of the characters, but there are a handful of smaller ones that I haven't just for time. Anything like that, come in with all the questions. At the very beginning, we're just gonna generate a question list so I have something to work from. And I'm gonna use that to work through the rest of the text. Hopefully that'll take us up to about 11. And then with the last half, I'm gonna kind of tee us up for how I think this is gonna help us for Holy Week and Easter, okay? I'm really, really sorry, but because of the other thing, I can't stick around for questions. So if you have any, just hold them or email them and we'll get to them later, okay? Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen. Thank you very much, all.
And thank you, Angie and Mark, for that wonderful copy of the seed bread.
Oh! Very good this week. I'm extremely proud of you.